everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is a program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you very much for tuning into my show this morning. We're going to be talking about the customer on the show today. We're going to be talking about you, the consumer, the person who is buying, the person who is voting with their dollars for what is produced in the economy. Because the customer is the center of the economy. They are the determinant of all value, of all prices, of all work. What is to be done? The consumer is the one who decides all of this. And it's a central role in the economy. The role of the consumer is what the Austrian school puts at the center of the economy. And every other school of economics gets this incorrect. And this is really coming up because I had an argument over the weekend with a friend of mine who thought that without the government regulating the economy, without licenses, and without the actions of our benevolent government intervening on the behalf of the customers, that customers would get run roughshod over by these companies, that the companies would charge ridiculously high prices, that they would pay their workers absolutely nothing, that they would bring us the most low-quality, universal kind of garbage products that you could ever imagine. And there would be recessions, there would be people who were committing suicide. He was actually commenting on an article about people who are committing suicide because of the recession and how their wealth was wiped out, how they went to go to the market and realized that their entire assets have been destroyed because of the fluctuations of the Federal Reserve printing money and introducing that money into the economy. But he wanted to blame it on capitalism. He wanted to blame it on something to do with the producers, with the company class making some sort of mischief for the customer. And so my friend levied this accusation against me. He said, "Racker, oh, Racker, I know that you believe in companies. I know that you believe that the producers are going to do the right thing. But in actuality, they're not. They're people. They want to take advantage of others. They want to charge high prices. They want to deliver garbage products. And so your idea about how the economy works without the government's central role, that capitalism is going to fail, that we have to turn to something like socialism or communism or some other production model than a producer class where these capitalists purchase goods, producer goods, they pay workers, and there's a hierarchical kind of labor management situation." And he said, this is automatically going to lead to problems if we allow it to occur. And my argument is that, no, you're leaving the customer out of this equation. You're not allowing the customer to be the center of the economy, who is determining what is produced, in what quantity, and at what price. That's right. I mean, it might seem like you don't really have a lot of control over prices, but in actuality, you do. It's just that you're part of 300 million people. And in actuality, if we look at the entire world, you're part of 6.5 billion people. So you do have a say on the prices, but they are also determined by every other person in the economy. But if we really look at this in the aggregate and we understand things from the Austrian economic perspective, we understand that the customer is central in all decisions of the entire economy. They are what determines prices. They are what determines what gets made and what companies are actually deciding. And it might not seem like this is the case. You might look at a business and say, well, the manager just walked into the room and said, "We're going to charge a higher price today." And then the prices went up, and then you see the prices going up. And so you might think that the business is the one that is making the decisions. But in actuality, they cannot make any decisions unless they have approval by the customers. So when a company makes a choice to increase the price of their particular product, they are expecting that customers are going to want to still purchase things at that particular price. And they're expecting that their competitors are not going to underbid them and cause the price to be lower. You know, if a new competitor comes into the market and says, "Well, I'm going to charge a dollar less than all of my competitors," you can imagine, given that quality is about the same, customers are going to run to this new company, and they are going to leave all the other companies who are going to be forced by this new company to undercut, to lower their prices in order to entice customers to come back to them. So again, the customer is the central role of all decisions in the economy. And the only time when this is not the case is when the government comes in and undermines the decisions of the customer. So this is most readily seen when the government subsidizes particular companies. That company gets money without having to have its product voted on by particular customers. So that customer did not approve of that company. They didn't go in and say, I'd like to purchase your product at the price that you're offering at, all things considered, what I could have bought if I didn't buy your product. But no, the government comes in and subsidizes a particular company, causing it to rise above any competitors that might have been able to enter into the market and compete for the customer's dollar. In the same way, when government regulates any particular industry, it is benefiting some of the companies, the ones that can afford to abide by the regulations or to buy off, bribe the regulators, then you're going to find that that company is exalted above the status of its competitors' companies. And so, therefore, that company can override the customer's preferences. It really can ignore what it is that the customer actually wants. And so when we're talking about fascism, when we're talking about the joining together of the government and companies, when companies use the government to attack their competitors or to steal money from the customers without that will of those customers, when they use licenses to destroy other competitive people who might have entered into the market and provided alternative products, maybe a higher quality, maybe a lower price, this is fascism. This is what causes the customer's preferences to be overridden, and the customer is no longer the central role of the economy when we have a state-regulated, a state-enforced, and state laws on economic behavior. So before I talk a little bit about the central role of the customer in all decision-making capacity, in an article written by Christopher Wesley, I'd like to just address, like, why are we talking about this? For what reason? And I just want you all to know how much power you have as an acting customer in the economy, that you have a role that is of such crucial importance to the direction of how things are produced and why we're producing them for your desires, and that you have complete control over what producers are allowed to produce things in the economy. It's such a central and important understanding to realize the power that you have when you go into a business and you vote for that particular business. I want to grant you this power, because every single time that you concede to the government that it should make this decision for you, you are giving up some of that power, and you no longer have the acting capacity to vote against particular companies. You know, it seems like in our economy that these corporations, they do really run roughshod over us. They are these huge monolithic organizations. It seems like they're untouchable. There's only like one or five that you might be able to choose from. And, you know, when you call up their customer support, they're a little bit curt to you. They put you on hold. They say that there's far too many people in the customer service queue, and you have to go back to the end of the line and wait 20 minutes for you to get a customer service representative. And, you know, it seems like these companies really can do whatever they want. But again, this is because the government has passed laws which allows them to consolidate and centralize and cartelize against the customer. So producers really do want to harm the customer. They do want to charge as high prices as they possibly can, but they cannot do that unless they have the government law and the guns of the state in order to enforce those laws behind them. They can't cartelize themselves in a particular way without the government. And so, you know, it's the cart before the horse. If you're trying to regulate businesses into obeying the customer, you have to actually let the customer make those decisions and realize that freedom is the best way to achieve our goals, which is a peaceful and productive and a prosperous society. So the first article I want to read is How Karl Menger Put Customers at the Center of Economic Science. This article is by Christopher Wesley. One of my favorite economists in the history of economic thought is the great Austrian Karl Menger, 1840 to 1921. While the mainstream of economics profession acknowledges Menger's place due to his contribution to the marginalist revolution in the 1870s, it otherwise ignores him because his theoretical framework does not lend itself to policy prescriptions. In an era in which the economics profession largely views itself as a shadow branch of government, which is itself charged with managing the economy, thinkers like Menger and those who work in his tradition are not going to be extolled or studied in the same way that thinkers like Irving Fisher, John Maynard Keynes, Milton Friedman, or Paul Krugman have been. This is true if only because the government tends not to fund academics or economic schools of thought that do not promote its central role in the economy or provide economic justifications for its interventions in market forces. Absent this connection, the study of Chicago School monetarism or Ivy League Keynesianism would have much less prominence in economic science today. Menger's theoretical framework differs from so many of the modern interpretations of economics because he represented the culmination of a pre-progressive era development of economic thinking that had occurred over centuries, mostly in continental Europe by scholastic thinkers in the Middle Ages, as well as French liberals such as Turgot, Cantillon, and Say. Such people may have studied economics as a form of what was known as the moral sciences in the 19th century, but their impetus for doing so was often due to the innate human desire for better understanding the world and the natural laws that govern it. Their interest was in economics as economics and not simply as a policy tool to make government appear more scientific, efficient, or benign. Government is actually the exact opposite of these things. So to study economics as a science, pure and simple, especially in an era when it seems economic confusion reigns, it's not a bad choice to start with Karl Menger. Menger was born in Galicia, a then Austrian region that is now in Poland, to a wealthy family with roots in Bohemia. During breaks from the study of law at universities of Prague and Vienna, Menger worked as a financial journalist who developed some degree of prominence for writing novels and comedies that were serialized in newspapers. It was during his time as a journalist that Menger first noticed the significance of the discrepancies between classical economic doctrines on market phenomenon and the actual business market that he covered over the course of his profession. Soon after receiving his law degree from the University of Krakow in August 1867, Menger embarked on the formal study of political economy in an attempt to better understand and resolve these discrepancies, an effort that resulted in the 1871 publication of Principles of Economics. While Menger recognized that the classical economists had made significant contributions to the development of economic theory, he believed one of their primary shortcomings was their analyses of the consumer, a shortcoming which was perhaps epitomized by the classicals' emphasis on the labor theory of value and their rudimentary and even shallow price theory that explained prices as phenomena resulting mostly from the economic calculation of businessmen. Menger's primary contribution in Principles was to insert the primacy of the consumer in determining value and, by extension, price, not only in the marketplace, but in all economic activity. The Mengerian approach, which we today call the science of praxeology, emphasized the importance of individual human action resulting from the desire to satisfy felt needs and the relationship of those needs to the external world. Having a felt need and the knowledge that the external world possesses some characteristics that allow the individual to satisfy it provide the basis for logical human action and the subjective valuation of goods and services, both within and apart from the market. Menger further noted that as our knowledge about the external world changes, so do individually felt needs. Efforts to satisfy felt needs presuppose recognition of cause and effect relationships that provide the basis for all of human action. Note how completely irrelevant such a framework is to modern adherents of the Keynesian or Chicago schools of economics. The major difference is that both schools view the individual, person, or actor as an object that needs to be manipulated in the name of policy success. For Chicagoans, this success is based on market outcomes that are closer to their preconceived ideals regarding market efficiency, while for Keynesians, this success is based on the achievement of arbitrary short-run employment levels that are achieved in practice by penalizing savings and rewarding consumption. To both schools, the human person is a cog in an economic machine that must be coerced to act in ways that make their systems work. But in the 1870s, Menger boldly applied its implications to the determination of value. He noted that since goods are external to the human person and recognized subjectively as possessing qualities that allow for need, satisfaction, they could be differentiated between goods of different orders. In Principles, he describes first-order goods as being goods that we consume to satisfy our needs. These are consumption goods. Second-order goods are goods required to produce the first-order good, so that while a car may be a first-order good, satisfying a felt need for transportation, the second-order goods would include the glass, rubber, chrome, and all the other inputs which make up the car. The third-order goods are all of the goods that are required to produce the second-order goods, and so on, with more complex forms of production being characterized with more distant orders of production. Nonetheless, the values of all of the goods of whatever order are derived from the initial subjective desire on the part of the individual to satisfy a particular need, so that rubber has value not in itself or in the work effort going into its production, but because of the initial human desire for transportation, leading to a human preference for cars. This understanding of goods contrasted greatly with the classical economist's notion that the value of economic inputs is based on their technical usefulness in production. Menger's value theory represented an expansion of Say's law that supply creates its own demand and is the proper theoretical response to the monetary and credit cranks, who see no difference between government-created and directed capital and privately created and directed capital. In truth, government-created capital satisfies the needs of the political classes and the special interests connected to it, whereas privately directed capital is directed at the satisfaction of consumer wants. Absent the state's influence in the development of 20th century economic thought, it is likely Menger would be known today as an important classical economist who corrected known shortcomings of the classical school. That article was by Christopher Wesley. He is an associated scholar and former fellow at the Mises Institute. This comes out of the Mises Institute Free Market Magazine, which is a monthly publication that they print. So an important implication of this understanding that the customer is the central decision maker of all things in the economy and is what determines prices, not only of the final consumer good, but of all the orders of production, all the way back to mining steel out of a particular mountain. They are determining the value and the price of all of those goods. And so the implication here is that they are also determining the price of the laborer, of the person who is being paid a particular wage. So wages are not just arbitrary numbers thrown about by companies, and that they have absolute decree of what those wage prices are going to be. It's not that a company comes along and says, well, we're only going to pay our workers 10 cents an hour, and that's all we're going to pay for them. The determinant is the consumer's choice to make. The consumer is what values the final product and weighs it against all other products that they could have purchased, and is what determines the price of the factors of production, the laborers, the capital goods, the tools that we are all using to produce, and to produce bigger and better and more wonderful consumer goods. But it's very important to understand that those numbers are not just arbitrary. They're not just made up. They are actually determined by the customer who is providing his dollar to purchase from a particular company as opposed to a different company, as opposed to not buying that product at all. And so we can't get upset when wage rates aren't a particular level that we like. We can't get upset when a particular price of a product is not where we'd like it to be. Mises once said that wishing for a price is just a particular fanciful and mystical way of thinking. You can't. There's no such thing as a fair price. There's no way that you can bend the prices to the will of yourself. You have to compete with all the other customers who are bidding for that particular consumer good. It's not just you in the economy. I think that people tend to be a little self-centered when they're talking about economic activity. Well, I want this price to be lower. Well, I want my wage rate to be higher. Well, yeah, I'd like the quality of this product to increase. But you have to realize that economic behavior is not just about you. there are millions of other people who are all voting on consumer goods, and they're voting up prices, they're voting down prices. They are also behaving and acting in an economic sense and voting for companies that are producing goods for them. So it's not just about you. It's not just the self. It's not just the individual who gets the money that the government seizes from other people. In the economy, in the capitalist sense of mass production for the masses, we are basically determining the preferences of millions of different people. And prices are the way that we determine what it is that people want versus how much we actually have of it and how hard it is to produce a particular consumer good. So that's all very important to understand. And this kind of self-centered way of looking at the economy, where you can just kind of manipulate prices and change them based on the whims and fancies of whatever it is that the government says that prices should be. You know, Mises said a while ago that wishing for a fair price or something that is the price that you would like to see in the market is just kind of fanciful. It's mystical. It's a mythology to think that there is such a thing as a fair price. Prices are whatever it is that other people are voting on, whatever their preferences are, versus how hard it is to produce that particular good. And as a case example of this kind of government manipulation of prices in order to change the preferences of individuals in the economy, I'd like to talk a little bit about fracking, which is a process that's being used in the Midwest to kind of generate natural gas and use that for energy consumption in our economy. But it's causing all sorts of economic problems. The roads are being degraded very heavily because of the large, heavy machinery that they have to truck out to that place. And because the government is involved in both of these things, one, environmental production through its court systems, and two, the production and distribution of roads, then we are not actually seeing the true costs of fracking. And this practice might be done differently in a free society where consumers were actually voting based on the true price of a particular product. But what government can do is reduce the price, it can change the price, it can manipulate the price so that customers don't actually understand the true implications of what it is that they are purchasing. So this article is by Sal Ahmed, and it is called Government Roads, Subsidies, and the Costs of Fracking. Thanks to the extraction of oil through hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, the U.S. is not only on its way to being energy independent, but is predicted to become a net exporter of oil and gas by 2025. Serious drilling operations have yet to be started in the Utica Shale, which underlies much of the northeast part of the U.S., which is said to contain the richest deposits of natural gas and crude oil in the country. With the excavations in North Dakota's Bakken Shale alone, enough gas has been discovered to carry on for generations ahead. And since 2008, natural gas prices have decreased by almost 75%. Some of the original pioneers of fracking are impressive in their entrepreneurial and technical skills. Among fracking's innovators, including Harold Hamm, Aubrey McClendon, Tom Ward, and George Mitchell, few have a college degree or any experience in geology or oil drilling, and are simply examples of the creative energies that are unleashed by the market. Nonetheless, the fracking industry is most certainly not a free market industry and can be heavily dependent on government subsidies. Mitchell's impact on the development of fracking technology, for example, is sometimes regarded as equal to Henry Ford's impact on the automobile, but Mitchell was well known throughout the 80s and 90s for petitioning for federal government for increased support. Due to his successful track record in the Eastern Shales project, the Department of Energy granted Mitchell a fat check to develop technologies that drill deeper into the earth. In 1980, the Section 29 tax credit for unconventional gas companies was started. It supported large investments into infrastructure to carry out drilling operations, and it later led to tripling in production of non-conventional gas. It was during the late 90s that fracking technology's big breakthrough came, with the creation of, quote, slick water, the industry standard controversial blend of chemicals that are used in groundwater injections. The fluid is crucial in creating cracks in the thick sediment rock quickly and wide enough for the gas to leak upwards and be collected. Before its breakthrough, slick water had been the recipient of federal aid for over 25 years. the state initiatives taken on fracking issues. Go back to the 1950s, before natural gas became the favored household fuel. Over three decades, from the shale fields of Texas and Wyoming to the Marcellus in the east, the federal government contributed more than $100 million to develop fracking R&D projects, and billions more in tax breaks. As of 2013, the natural gas and petroleum industry account for roughly $3.2 billion in federal energy subsidies. Halliburton, along with two other companies, Apache and Chesapeake, dominate nearly 63% of the American pressure pumping market. In 2005, the Bush administration implemented the Safe Drinking Water Act, which exempted natural gas drilling on federal land and allowed drilling companies a loophole to not have to disclose the chemicals used in excavations. Meanwhile, there are real reasons to be concerned about the impact of fracking operations, including its impact on the environment and on infrastructure. As alarming as the environmental and health issues are concerning the carcinogenic and radioactive material found in fracking waste, the greatest economic cost comes to the taxpayer-funded roads. As a matter of fact, the costs of road damage due to oil-carrying heavy haulers running night and day have surpassed the tax revenues generated by fracking in most states. Indeed, many of the oil wells are located on federal land, so it shouldn't be beyond our comprehension as to why the bureaucracy throws out any consideration of the capital stock of the roads. In an interview with the director of Cornell's local roads program, he states that, quote, it's like the Wild West on those roads, and, quote, everybody is making up their own rules. It is more likely, however, that problems are not due so much to the lack of rules, but to a lack of respect for private property when matters of ownership are confused and obscured by government when it comes to federal lands, private property, and mineral rights. If roads were private, as was the land surrounding them, only through experience, a working price system, and trial and error could an owner calculate the true cost of oil drilling. Furthermore, property owners would be motivated to ensure that fracking's profitability would be sufficient enough to fix the severe wear and tear of the roads after drilling. Could fracking be sustained without subsidies and without free use of finite and fragile infrastructure? That remains unclear. Although now more of our energy is coming from renewable and nuclear energy, oil and gas subsidies continue to be substantial, and since the latter are finite resources, more attention needs to be paid toward what will power up our future in the long term. Even Penn State geologist Terry Englander, who is a leading proponent of fracking, admits, quote, it cannot provide long-term solutions. That article was by Sal Ahmed, and it's called Government Roads, Subsidies, and the Costs of Fracking. So I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Austrian Circle. We talked today about how the customer is the central role in the decision-making process of what gets produced in the economy. And we also talked about how the government undermines this role of the customer anytime it draws power away from the customer's decision. Anytime it subsidizes, regulates, bails out, does license requirements, things like that, it is undermining the choices of the customer. And we, of course, can only be poorer as a result of the choices being taken away from the customer. So I hope that you enjoyed this. Have a great week. Take care. Thank you.